Chapter 7 Mars Archives. The vibration of the jackhammer felt in the soles of the feet sometimes resulted in a low rumble as another section of cavern collapsed in on itself. During the waking hours, the construction never stopped, nor did the planning, as the two engineers pored over the blueprints laid out on one of the long folding tables adorning the floor of the inflatable dome. Trying to perform this task inside the cavern while the heavy equipment did its thing would have been pointless. So the shelter situated on the top of Olympus Mons was earmarked as a quiet place to work. The entrance to the cavern was supplied by a rather large elevator platform, part of the floor of the inflatable dome. Leaving the platform through door number one took you out onto the surface, or, if you chose to exit the elevator through door number two, would bring you into the area where James and Ray Nance were, near the coffee maker. The two sat together, James, the chief engineer for the Calico, and his father, a regular visit to all the sites that Western Wave had constructed. Rachel had hired the company he worked for to do architectural planning, and Ray's expertise meant he spent more time in space than on the ground. "We got instructions from John that the new vessel was to be named Calico." "Why did he choose that name for the vessel, James?" his father asked. "The expected paint scheme," was the official answer. "But I think he just wanted to make sure the new ships were not stigmatized by his daughter's humor, or lack thereof. So now we have a cat theme." Pointing to a section near the center of the ship, James said, "The ring is meant to produce a 1/4 gravity on the occupants, and the concave floors are going to be sitting in tilt pad bearings that will align the forward acceleration with the rotating of the ring." "James, that seems like an overly complicated way to do it. Why not just have the floor of the ring tangent to the axis of rotation and call it good?" Ray asked. "John wants to try this configuration, and he's willing to pay for it. I have been modeling a scaled-down version to give to you so that way you can get a good grasp of what he wants. Really, Dad, if it were up to me, I'd want it this way, too. It will not matter if we are accelerating forward or backward. The floor will inherently move to maintain the angular momentum about the center of mass for the spinning system. The acceleration vector will always feel correct. We'll start work on it, of course. It just seems excessive, is all." "I'm okay with being excessive. This ship is meant to be out in the depths of space for extended periods of time, and during normal work hours, we'll always be at zero G. The idea of being able to eat and commune and relax in a reasonable acceleration field is fine with me." James had been stationed on Mars, working out the kinks in the designs, and having his father there to bounce ideas off of was a good thing. Ray and Rachel had met through the architectural company she used for designing the base on the moon and then on Mars. Ray had a background in structural analysis and metallurgy, which allowed him quite a bit of lunar and Mars time, as he was the one making recommendations about how best to utilize the area inside the caverns. Now he was working directly with his son and a bunch of military types, and they all had ideas about how best to build a ship of this magnitude. It had been Ray who had recommended his son to Rachel several years ago. He had experience in the Navy and had graduated college with a degree in mechanical engineering, and was a steady sort of person. Rachel had taken a liking to him at their first meeting, and the two had begun a relationship that John was not thrilled with. "He's going to be gone a lot, Rachel, so how well do you think that kind of long-distance couple works out? I'll tell you, it usually doesn't." John's warning was lost on his daughter. "I guess we'll see, Dad." The Calico was broken down into sections. The entire thing would be built at the Mars Transfer Station, located in synchronized orbit above the moon's surface. But the materials required for the construction would have to be ferried up from Earth. Eventually, the 120-foot-long ship would be fully assembled and ready for testing. Most of the ship was taken up with fuel tanks. The fuel would be mostly water, which would cover the crew's work and rest area. A separate set of tanks would comprise the skin of the ship. And in these tanks would be the holding area for the liquid hydrogen that the reactor was cracking from the available water. This hydrogen would be used in conjunction with the heavy isotopes to produce the thrust for the plasma engines. Basically, the crew would be surrounded by these liquid layers to protect them from the harmful cosmic rays that would be encountered. The outer shell, which included the hydrogen tanks, were an 18-inch thick hardened layer consisting of materials designed to disrupt electrical fields and to provide protection for the ship. It was exactly what John wanted. A lot could be thrown at it, and even if fractured, the internal framework would not be affected. Each of the hydrogen tanks were relatively small, independent, and self-sealing. So even if several were critically damaged, the loss would be minimal, and the repair painless. Then there was the design itself. The skin was a two-piece suit consisting of a top and bottom that basically mirrored each other. The inner portion of the ship, with the huge water tanks, would have the pieces draped over and then affixed with a clamping mechanism. It was done this way for several reasons, but the most obvious was that if one or both layers were to be damaged beyond repair, the piece could be ejected and a new skin put in its place in a short period of time. Far above the skin was a compression coil assembly. This Lisajou-shaped rail system was specifically designed for the Step 4 drive. Shannon's design had the ship step to the fourth level first, then it would transition back to whichever of the other steps it needed. As John had pointed out many times to her, if for some reason the ship could not get to Step 4, they wouldn't be able to use any of the other steps either. He had to admit that in the worst case, they could build a set of coils that could get them on step if needed, and so he relented. It was truly a fine-looking ship that she and Vlad had dreamed up. The coils were positioned by a superstructure that was at the heart of the ship's design, not only being the support for the rails, but also the support for the ring that would provide the artificial gravity. Along with this were 2 5-inch Navy guns that could be directed to fire on targets by means of an elevated turret system. This structure also held the weapons cache and the location for the Combat Information Center, CIC, and the 2 operators who would man the station. The coils had an added benefit of being home to 33 telescopic cameras that had been purchased by President Bishop specifically for this ship. The telescopic cameras were individually mounted in cutouts that allowed them to swing around on gimbaled supports to maximize the viewing area for each scope, while at the same time not interfering with the operation of the compression coils themselves. The cameras could be orientated to get the maximum number on a target, or they could all be pointed in different directions for a true 360-degree coverage. One of the conditions required by the purchase was that the developer of the cameras was going to accompany the ship on a few of the first flights to instruct and put his rendering software to the test. The superstructure was also home to the plasma thrust exhaust nozzles that would propel the vessel. 8 in total. The arrangement had 4 of the accelerator nozzles pointed forward and 4 pointing aft. This configuration meant the ship could be moved in any direction, and each of the nozzles could be brought into service at any time. Forward of the structure was the ring that was being discussed by James and his father. It was supported by the front of the superstructure and was just about as large. Most of what was seen from the outside was the housing for the ring as the mechanism sat nestled beneath a layer of protection from the elements and whatever else they encountered. Towards the rear of the ship, behind the reactor, sits an area dedicated to pressurized storage. A large space that runs from one side of the ship to the other, with doors on either side, an area where a significant amount of the equipment is housed, where work can happen without the need for an EVA suit. The list included equipment for drilling and analyzing, seismic survey, specimen storage, and transportation. Tucked away in its own space, below the storage area, was a large cylindrical tube whose length was more than one half the width of the ship. This tube had a detachable thrust unit and life support, along with several removable outer skins that could be fixed to the tube's outer surface. Depending on the skin, it could transform into a truck, or a medical clinic, or a place to store potentially hazardous material. It was not known if the isolation pod, IP, would be needed, but being a multipurpose device meant that the crew could use it in many roles. West Archives. One of the main tasks that the Calico would be performing was the distribution of the new and improved Step 4 relays. Enough testing had been done to know the range of the units exceeded the previous relays by a significant amount, so the planned drop points for the relays was adjusted accordingly. Then there was the locations that received additional hardware. Every fifth relay got a 5,000-gallon storage vessel that would be filled with water and supplies prior to leaving Earth. The vessel had a storage compartment that held a good amount of food, some tools, and several gases in high-pressure tanks in the event a ship ran into trouble and required servicing. All this equipment was to be stored outside on the back half of the ship, on the top and bottom skins. It was estimated that the Calico would be able to carry nearly 10 tanks and 50 relays using this configuration. The storage tanks contained a hollow tube that ran along the center line. The idea being, once the ship reached a drop point, any remaining stores would be inserted into the tube and it would be sealed. Then the whole thing would be simply ejected from the storage location. The water would eventually transform into ice and act as a shield, protecting the stores from degradation due to the cosmic rays that would be constantly passing through the skin. The ice would also double as fuel for any ship that needed it. A Step 4 relay would be clipped onto the side of the vessel and left to do its thing. At a non-depot location, the relay was simply turned on and ejected. The Calico would barely have to stop to accomplish this task. And of course, all this equipment, like all the stuff on the moon and on Mars, had the signature markings of the company Western Wave stamped on the surface. Miguel suggested adding the statement, "If found, please call Mars Station." Rachel Archives. The first time it took the BJ 2 weeks to deploy a single step relay was the last time the BJ deployed step relays. There were 8 of them positioned along the intended path to the Alpha Centauri system, and they were all functioning properly, happily being part of a network that ended abruptly. As it stood, the BJ was no longer the candidate to cross the ocean of space to another system. "People are just going to have to wait," Rachel told herself when criticisms arose. The BJ was too important a tool to be taken offline for such extended periods of time, and the Calico was well along on the construction timeline. "If it weren't for the BJ moving hull and superstructure components from Earth to Mars, the ship would never get built," she comforted herself with the thought. This was true enough, as the BJ became the workhorse for the system, and everybody wanted a piece of it, or at least a ride. The ship's large carrying capacity and speed meant that the orders could be filled quickly, and any resupplies or tending could be done with the smaller vessels. The BJ stood alone in its class and would continue to, as any idea of creating another was quickly dismissed. All the resources of Western Wave were firmly ensconced in the construction of the Calico, with a significant amount of Earth's resources being utilized to outfit her with the necessary equipment to justify the term Exploration Starship. Not only equipment, but the expertise to operate and interpret the results of the equipment was being assembled. Western Wave no longer had exclusive rights to who would be qualified candidates to accompany the team of explorers, but John did retain the right to disqualify a candidate. This made a lot of people mad, but he stood his ground. The ship would be a family that had to deal with each other through thick and thin. There was no way he was going to allow a presence on the ship that might be a cancerous influence, rotting the cohesion of the group from within. The well-choreographed assault on Saul's closest neighbor would see the ship lay in the remaining Step 4 relays and the resupply depots already built. These emergency life rafts, with their fuel and supplies, meant that a ship could make it back at Step 3 if necessary, though it would be excruciatingly slow. Once they arrived in the system, four satellites would be positioned based on the information gathered by the experts. These satellites were designed to test the solar wind, electrical and magnetic properties inside the star's heliosphere, determining the star's sunspot activities, and then to analyze the local planetary atmospheric compositions and densities. If deployed around a planet, the surface would be mapped with radar as well. All the satellites would have a dedicated step relay, so the data could be examined in greater detail back on Earth. The Calico would spend between 2 and 3 weeks exploring the system before returning home for a break, system checks, and upgrades. The upgrades would be a regular occurrence, as ideas for what the ship should carry was a fluid thing. Then there was the ship's crew. They would be running 2 10-hour shifts, meaning that the crew size was twice what it took to operate the vessel. The job would not be strenuous or mentally taxing. In fact, the word boring might best describe the work. But regardless, there would be 2 of everything. Pilot, navigation, command, engineering, reactor, and most importantly, cooks. The redundancy was excessive, but John needed experienced people to run these ships, and that meant exposure. Then there were the 5 candidates from the Space Force Academy that Marty talked John into taking along as students of space travel. That brought the count to 23. But as John pointed out, "There's a placard next to the one room with my name on it, so I'm going." This meant the total headcount for the mission was set at 24. A cutout on either side of the ship was dedicated for Step 2 skiffs that could be accessed from the supply area through a sealed walkway. This allowed the pilot to use the small ships without having to suit up every time it was moved. Both craft were a variation on the Hejastro, though somewhat smaller in size and much lighter in mass. They were made to carry equipment and personnel on short trips. The skiff would turn out to be a favorite pastime for the cadets as they began practicing the art of moving, evading, and attacking the various individuals that made up the crew of the Calico. On the day that the Calico made its way over to Deimos to take on a partial load of fuel, the excitement was evident, but the fanfare kept to a minimum. The trials would begin throughout the solar system, culminating in a final push towards Alpha Centauri. The ship would not be alone, however. It was to be joined by the entire population of Earth, as the step relay broadcasts the activities throughout the entire journey. This was the reason that after taking on the final fuel and supplies from the Mars Transfer Hub, there were no goodbyes, simply good luck and Godspeed. The Earth was about to begin another grand voyage through space. Calico Archives. The daily video feed from the Calico usually showed Shannon and Miguel on one shift, while Trevor and Anne had the other. Vlad was spending most of his time with James in engineering, but would float between the 2 shifts to provide breaks to the operators. The idea of John's team, all on an experimental ship, crossing light years of space, concerned a lot of people who were not actually passengers. The 2 people most concerned were Rachel and Susan Capshaw. The back and forth discussion had gone nowhere, as it became obvious that this was going to happen. And if the ship died, then the tech died with it, or so people thought. Now that Shannon oversaw design, her work had been archived, and only she and Rachel knew about it. But the knowledge did little to alleviate the tension. Who would I turn to for help if something happens? This was a fear that would occasionally well up in Rachel's heart, and her father's recommendation didn't help. Sell the company and go buy a boat. I hear they're relaxing. Rachel didn't want a boat. She wanted them to come back in one piece and never do this to her again. The 48-day of 10% thrust at step 4 saw the Calico arrive at Proxima Centauri. The dim star was home to several planets that Dr. Schubert's telescopic cameras had charted, but this was not their intended destination. Two satellites got deployed, one at 90 degrees to the plane of the system, and the other in orbit around the second of three visible worlds. Having accomplished this task, the Calico continued along the intended course. 90 hours later, the ship arrived at Alpha Centauri, and cheers were heard throughout both systems as celebrations ensued. What was deemed a foolish dream just a few years ago had become reality, and how long before this spectacle becomes routine? John wondered with a gleeful heart. Well, we did it. He raised his glass to the assembled crew. I can retire happy, knowing that we did what we set out to accomplish. Yeah, right, Rachel's voice could be heard saying through the ether. This brought on a wave of laughter from several corners. Seriously, I need to retire at some point. And this phase of the company's expansion might be the best time to try. I've talked it over with Shannon several times. Both of his daughters took on a melancholy mood. The whole world had just heard what he had said, and they knew it. There was more to this retirement statement than he was letting on. Sarah was the first to comment. Tell you what, Dad, if Rachel and I agree to it, then you can retire, not before. This prompted a rousing cheer from a large group of people, and the celebrations continued. The excitement faded into work and routine as the crew began the survey of the system. Hey, Doc, what's on your mind? John asked the telescope engineer, who President Bishop had commissioned for this trip. Would you have time to stop by my lab? I'd like to show you something. Bouncing his way through the corridor, he ran into Sarah, quite literally. You want to go see what the doctor has cooking? The doctor's lab consisted of a rack of equipment and a desktop computer. It brought in all the images from the telescopic cameras mounted to the compression coils, and his software would render out a picture of what he was most interested in. Today, he was interested in the dimming stars throughout the rendering. What do you think is causing it, Doc? John asked, not sure if he genuinely cared. Well, if I had to guess, I would say it's an asteroid belt, but as you can plainly see, the belt seems to be in a diagonal line. John's eyes did not see anything plainly in the footage, but he trusted the doctor knew his equipment. Want to go have a look? He queried his daughter. How far do you think this ribbon of yours is, doctor? Sarah asked, a bit more skeptical. Oh, I can't say for sure. A long way away, though, he surmised. Father and daughter exchanged looks with a slight grin on their faces. Doc, you said you noticed it when we were over in the Proxima system, and it shifted. Is that about right? Yes, it has shifted slightly. Okay, well, we continue on a baseline directly away from Proxima, but the same distance. You'll have 3 points of reference to get an idea of the amount of parallax shift. Seems like a straightforward process. What do you think, Sarah? After the satellite deployment was complete, and with a quick look at the most obvious planetary bodies, the Calico left the system heading deeper into space. The doctor was right. The light from the distant stars were being affected by this haze that seemed to form a straight line against the backdrop. There was nothing to see but the fading starlight to indicate its presence. But something was out there. The hope was that this baseline would be enough to give a distance. "About 3 light-years from here," the doctor informed the eager listeners. This caused the excitement to diminish significantly. "But it appears that the really interesting stuff stretches farther on at an angle of around 60 degrees from the Sol Centauri baseline. There's a far denser patch that's about 7 light-years from the Centauri system."
7 light-years from here?
Sarah's blank look and almost sarcastic voice was lost on the doctor. "Yes, Captain. It appears to be one continuous band of debris that stretches for light-years. How anything like that could possibly form is beyond my imagination."
"Simple, Doc," Johns flatly stated. "Something big waged a war with a Birkeland current and lost."
This caused him to redden and chuckle to himself.
Very few listening in on the conversation caught the reference, and fewer still got the joke.
"I see," the doctor said, knowing full well that he did not.
The president's science advisor interrupted at this point.
"Is it feasible for Calico to reach that far?"
"Not this trip, no," Sarah noted. "We would need to develop a staging area here in this system first, then have the step relays and the drop points to reach that far, directly from Earth. It would take a bunch of resupplies, but it could be done, if that is truly the direction we want our exploration to follow."
"I'm game," John said enthusiastically.
"I thought you were retiring," Sarah said with a quizzical look.
"I am, just not today."